You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, David.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Pretty good. Finishing up a book. You know what that's like, going over the last galleys, still finding things, typos, little mistakes, word choices.
Books don't have mistakes, David, but I can still muster some empathy for you just through sheer imagination.
You're a very creative mind.
Yeah. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show. Although actually by the time it airs, it'll be called Robert Wright's Non-Zero. That's one thing we're going to talk about is rebranding today, David. But first, let me tell people who you are. You're David Korn, in case there's anybody that doesn't know. DC Bureau Chief of Mother Jones, MSNBC analyst, possessor of, maybe you're not even keeping track, but possessor of close to 1 million Twitter followers. You're at 964,000 or something, David. Did you know that?
I knew I was in that area. I haven't topped 1 million yet, but I'm sure after this episode,
this will
put me over the top.
Easily. Let me tell people what this is about. We are here to, among other things, celebrate the life and legacy of Blogging Heads TV, David, which is undergoing a little life passage now. It's being rebranded as Non-Zero. That's what the YouTube channel will say now. Non-Zero, not coincidentally, is also the name of a newsletter I put out on Substack. Speaking of which, you have a newsletter. What's it called? Our Land?
Our Land.
Our
Land. Our Land. O-U-R, Land. Our Land. Belongs to all of us, although the newsletter is just mine, sorry. And it's not a Substack newsletter.
Ooh, Maverick. But
people can go to davidkorn.com to get their free trial subscription.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have time to talk about why you made the radical decision to have a non-Substack newsletter. But meanwhile, I want to say, you are here because you were one of the very first Blogging Heads. So Mickey Kaus and I started Blogging Heads in November 2005, along with a tech genius named Greg Dingell. You were the third non-Bob and Mickey guest.
Wow.
Matt Iglesias edged you out for the number two slot. He showed up in January of 2006. Mm-hmm. A younger and more energetic man, David. Frankly, he just beat you. He was just hungrier.
You know, you got to watch out for those young bucks.
I know the type.
Maybe the first time Matt's ever been described that way, but nevertheless.
The lean and hungry type, as I think Shakespeare said.
So who was number one?
Eric Umansky, who is now ProPublica. Do you know Eric?
Not well, but I know Eric.
Yeah, and he was at Slate at the time, I think. Yeah. And so you came on with me, and then the next week, I think, with Mickey. And do you want me to, I'll tell you what the title of the first segment you and I talked about, and I want to see if you can remember what it is a reference to. Because okay. I, even if I hadn't looked back, this is maybe the part of my Blogging Heads discourse with you that I most remember because it was so much fun to talk about. The title is Cheney's Alcohol Issue.
And this was 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And that we should tell people.
January 2006 or February.
We're talking about Dick Cheney, not uh-huh. Liz Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
For the youngsters out there who might not recall him. It was the middle of the Iraq War, but I'm trying to figure out. We talked a lot in those days about.
I'm going to give you an important hint. Okay.
Okay.
The next week you had a conversation with Mickey. And the first topic title was Hunting Season Over Already?
Well, was this when he blew off the face of his friend?
This is when he shot a friend while on a hunting expedition, yes.
And so were we speculating at the time, was there public speculation that Cheney had downed one too many
beverages? I think there was speculation. I doubt it started with you and me, but we would have been happy.
I mean, I don't I'm a reporter. I don't speculate.
No, it's facts.
I sometimes speculate about speculation that already exists.
Well, that's what you're doing now.
Which I'm trying not to speculate. But was that the alcohol problem we were referring to?
Yeah, I think so. We had a good time with that. It was those were the days. So the other memory I have of you, Blogging Heads related memory, I was down in DC, and you know, Blogging Heads was a going, it was a big going thing. You know, at some point the New York Times started featuring it on the homepage, and you were one of their star. You would have these debates with Jim Pinkerton that were frequently featured on the homepage of the New York Times. But I don't know if this was before or after that, but I was down in DC in a Starbucks with you, and we were starting to talk about, like, well, what's going to happen? Is this going to become a money-making thing? And you, of course, being you, were already bringing up the issue of revenue shares. Being a market-oriented, free, very, very pro-free market guy, as you are.
With a collectivist, you know.
Ultimately, you would have redistributed the income, of course, to the needy, David. I understand that. But, and you were talking about that, and some young woman walks up and looks at you and said, I saw you on Blogging Heads TV.
Yes.
And then she walks off, and I said, David, you should be paying me. And you were not persuaded.
I paid her so that I could get a bigger piece of the revenue sharing. That's what was going on. I wanted to make sure you realized my value to the enterprise here.
Anyway, the revenue was not forthcoming as things panned out.
I missed those days of debate and discourse with Jim Pinkerton. I mean, I like Jim. I think one of the casualties of the Trump years is that we've lost that sort of aspect of our overall national political conversation. I mean, it's one thing to talk to people, you know, talk to someone and disagree about foreign policy, housing policy, tax policy, even immigration policy with Mickey, whatever. It's quite another thing to disagree over whether it's a good thing to honor the Constitution or not. You know, whether we should have policies that allow hundreds of thousands of people to die or not, whether we should have a president who lies over 30,000 times in 4 years, according to Glenn Kessler and others of the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Trump years have just brought us so many awful and absurd things to argue about and to draw lines over that we are unable to then address these other matters that you and I, for decades, really, you know, as young journalists, you know, would enjoy, would relish discussing with people who you might say on the other side or on your own side, but who you disagreed with over something at that point in time.
Yeah, it was a different era. Unlike Matt Iglesias, for example, and unlike many of the people who constituted kind of the Blogging Heads crowd early on, you were not a blogger at the time. Remind me, have you always been a magazine guy? Were you at The Nation at the time?
I was at that point, you know, for the first few years of this, Blogging Heads, I was at The Nation. I moved to Mother Jones in 2007, I believe. And around that time, I'd have to go back and check the archives. I also, you know, I had a column for The Nation magazine, an online column that went up whenever I wanted to put it up. It was quasi-bloggy. Mm-hmm. And then I also did a blog for CQ.
Okay.
For a while, I was a quasi-blogger for The Guardian, on and off. So, I mean, I was not like a full-bore blogger. I was a journalist who had already been established as a journalist who then was asked by certain institutions to be what they then called a blogger. So it wasn't my core of my professional identity, but I played a blogger on
TV.
TV.
Yeah. Because I was going to ask, just how you would, you know, I mean, one thing that's changed hugely is the media landscape. It had changed by the time we started Blogging Heads relative to the time you and I got into journalism. Because blogs, that was a very different scene from magazines. And it's changed a lot since, I guess, owing largely to social media, but not exclusively. Yeah. And I'm wondering what you think of all the changes. I mean, whether you, like many people, are lamenting the demise of America and American discourse and everything else, or what?
Well, you know, I remember when I used to have to write my columns with a quill pen by candlelight. And, you know, the only person who got to see them was whoever I would show them to, because we didn't have copy machines.
I remember those days.
You remember those days? So things have certainly changed a lot since then. You know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, the internet and the information or whatever you want to call it, revolution, the digital media revolution, you know, opened things up a lot. You know, you know, the saying was never get in an argument with someone who could buy ink by the barrel. There are lots of gatekeepers, and the process, it was expensive to produce a newspaper or a magazine. And only a few of us had the honor or privilege of being able to write, you know, particularly stories that, you know, sharing your ideas or your analyses. It was a very small and world of people who were given that privilege and to be paid to do it, you know, as a livelihood. And then, you know, once the internet came along and people realized, hey, I can type, tap away and put it up there, and whoever wants to can come and take a look at it. You know, all of a sudden there was a lot of competition to the professionals out there, right? Mm. And opinions, you know, there's an old saying, opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one. And so people started blogging away. And of course, like with every human endeavor, most people are not good at what they're, you know, not great at whatever they're trying to do, but some people were quite good at it, and they didn't need to be part of the New Republic, National Review, The Nation, Mother Jones, The New York Times, whatever, to start developing a following and an audience. And people of that generation started looking towards these peers doing all this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought it was great. It was wild and woolly. It created a lot of competition. And the way that the barriers came down, the barriers to entry, that allowed people like Matt Iglesias and Ezra to develop a following. The same thing worked for people like me. I was working at the Nation magazine at the time, and I didn't, you know, I always looked at, you know, established media. You know, you can call it mainstream media. I don't use that as pejorative, you know, but whatever, conventional, but big media, as sort of the competition that was impossible to compete with. Possible to compete with the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the networks, and all that. When you're working at the Nation magazine and all you have are 180,000 subscribers and you write once a week and it gets put on this piece of paper and has to go through the post office to get to them. To get other people to see your work and care about what you're doing and have any impact was quite an uphill climb. Every once in a while you had a big enough story that other people had to pay attention to. But otherwise, you were kind of really just working your own patch, mm-hmm. and not a very large patch. But with the internet, and once the Nation magazine and everybody else went online, all of a sudden you are able to compete with the big boys, the big girls, whatever you want to say. And I remember the epiphany I had about this, I remember the day it happened. It was the day of the Supreme Court argument in Bush v. Gore. Which was, I guess, in December 2000.
Right. It was about the election that wound up determining the outcome of the election, basically.
Yeah. And my office for the Nation magazine then was literally across the street from the Supreme Court. And I went to the hearing and I, you know, sussed out what I wanted to write about, went back to my office, wrote something really quick, you know, not even sure it was edited, but it was like a blog, and it went up within an hour. And I got all of a sudden like hundreds of thousands of hits, which was a big deal at the time. You get that many, still is now.
Still is.
Yeah. And I realized that my piece was up before places like the Times and the Post and AP, right, and others. Right. I mean, I was just physically across the street and did something very quick. And I just said, you know, I was sort of like, oh my goodness, this means now, you know, and this was on a breaking news sort of thing. It wasn't that I had anything to say that was much different than anybody else. But I said, this means now that if you have something that gets enough attention, either because you're there first or because you have something, information that other people don't have yet, a scoop, as we call it, you can actually get a gigantic audience as big as, almost as big as if it had appeared on the Times site or any place else. And so while bloggers were able to come in and challenge people like you and me and institutions, there was a great leveling amongst the institutions that did exist. Now, of course, the downside of this is that a lot of people who are putting out disinformation, propaganda, and bad information were able to use the same means, and there were no gatekeepers or guardians to say, or referees to say no to them. So the whole environment became more chaotic and unruly, which has both upsides and downsides. And I'm reminded of my favorite New Yorker cartoon of all time, which is Charles Dickens, sitting in front of a copy editor, old style desk, and the editor is saying, "Now surely, Mr. Dickens, it could not have been both the best of times and the worst of times." But so, yeah. And, but then it seems, but blogging, as you know, and you can talk to this, kind of like became absorbed by the great media beast that was out there. Yeah. And a lot of the great bloggers got picked up by institutions that existed and were, absorbed and institutionalized. And now, and there's really no one out there now who you think of as a blogger, but there are people who have voice, who are highlighted by, their institutions, whether it's The Atlantic or The New York Times, and they do things that some of them are kind of bloggy, some are just old style columnists. And I think of someone like Adam Serwer, who was blogging at The American Prospect, a modest sized liberal progressive magazine, does a lot of good work. I noticed what he was doing. I hired him to come to Mother Jones. Mm-hmm. And I said, "But I want you to blog. I want you to be a writer, a reporter." And he did that, and he did very well, so well that he got poached by a couple of different places.
Where is he now?
Well, he's at The Atlantic now.
Okay.
And he ends up being, a pretty, wonderful, established magazine writer, essayist of sorts at The Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
He's not blogging anymore. He's not doing, but he has a very sort of conventional position, having come out of blogging. And that's happened with a lot of the best bloggers.
Now, let me, the other big change and possibly related change, parallel with changes in the media, has been the much discussed growth in, polarization, tribalism, partisan bitterness, so on. And, by the way, if all goes according to plan, we may be honored by a visit from no other than Mickey Kaus eventually. And this will be a natural segue, if so, to conversation with him, because as you may have heard, he voted for Donald Trump. And that is the latest and most intense incarnation, I guess, of the polarization thing. But you, like me, are old enough to remember the things, that there may never have been a golden age of American concord. I mean, we were both pretty, pretty young journalists when Newt Gingrich came along. Now, I do think he was a little bit of a pioneer of partisan bitterness, kind of, right? Like, he helped take it. And look, I got to say, I apologize, David and I are both liberals and kind of Democrats. And I'll try. And in fact, I was going to step in and kind of quasi challenge you earlier when you were kind of listing a series of very early in the conversation of things that Trump or Trumpists or Trump supporters kind of believe or said, and ask you whether, aren't there some comparable sins committed on the other side? But we can say that for when Mickey comes in. What I want to say now is that I try very hard to be as objective as possible and so on. But Newt Gingrich, and look, there had always been, cheap shot artists and so on and demagogues. But Newt Gingrich was something a little new, right? I don't think that's a hallucination on our part.
Yes and no. And it's funny you should raise this, because The book I'm finishing up literally as we talk, I should be looking at the last four chapters of The Galleys, but instead
which is called American Psycho and is not about
American Psychosis.
Oh shit. Well, I like you can, well, American you can have Psycho a follow up on Gingrich himself called American Psycho, but go ahead. Sorry. Okay. American Psychosis.
The book is called American Psychosis, and it's about the Republican Party's long-term relationship with extremism, racism, bigotry, paranoia, conspiracy theory. And my thesis is that the party, basically from McCarthyism on, has encouraged and exploited extremism in American politics. And I make the argument, you know, that it's not a both sides type of thing. And you can look at a lot of different examples. If you just go back and start with McCarthyism, McCarthyism accused the Democrats of literally being a conspiracy to destroy the nation. Conspiracy so immense that people like, you know, Truman himself, but everyone in his administration, everybody who supported Democrats.
George Marshall.
Yeah, George Marshall was the one he targeted directly, who wasn't even necessarily a Democrat, but that they were in league with a foreign power to purposefully undermine, subvert, and destroy America. Not that they were wrong, but they were purposefully, consciously plotting to do this. And they're, you know, and McCarthy was lionized in the 1952 convention. You know, eventually he went against the army and he was taken down a notch or two and was, you know, and half the party turned against him. But there's no equivalent on the Democratic side of anybody being that demagogic, extreme, and conspiratorial at that level. You can always find, and I'm not talking about progressives or lefties, you can find lefties out there who say all sorts of things the way you can find righties who say all sorts of things. My standard is what the party does. And so to bring in, you know, I do the whole history, but to jump a few iterations to Newt Gingrich, who you were mentioning, Newt Gingrich, you know, put out a list of words to use to demagogue against the Democrats. They were sick. They were radical. They were traitors. They were disloyal. They were anti-children. And he did this when he was the number two Republican on the House side on his way to becoming House Speaker.
He actually sent around the list to Republicans and said, these are the words to use, the labels to apply to Democrats. Like,
Yes. Uh-huh. They it was written about at the time. I revisit it in the book. The list is out there. You can Google it, or you can wait and buy American Psychosis when it comes out September 13th. But there is no, and the things that he said, he told one group of Republicans that they had to fight against Democrats with the savagery of a civil war. He said that Bill Clinton had to be challenged as being the enemy of normal Americans. There are no, you cannot give me an example of a Democrat who became House Speaker and had that amount of influence in the party who talked in those terms and tried to engage in that sort of politics. You can look at John Boehner and the Tea Party. The Tea Party would have rallies that he sponsored, you know, in which they would call the Democrats Nazis or even spit at some members of the Democratic Party, and they would come up with all these conspiracy theories that Barack Obama was a secret Muslim socialist who wanted to destroy America purposefully. Again, there is no, you can talk about the left being crazy about this or the other thing, but there is no parallel on the Democratic side where leading Democrats fully embraced a political force.
Okay, but you know the parallel that is springing to the mind of some people who disagree with you right now, pretty contemporary parallel. Can you guess? You want no?
Tell me.
Well, I think what they would say is the is Russiagate.
But you know, but this is where they're wrong. Russia happened. It happened. You know, you don't have to take my word for it. You can take Robert Mueller's word for it. You can take the intelligence community word for it. These are not lefties who've come up with this crazy
Mueller
idea.
But let me
finish. You can look at the Senate Intelligence Committee when it was run by Republican Marco Rubio. No one should be allowed to talk about Russia unless they've read volumes 2 and 5 of the Senate Intelligence Committee report, because it clearly shows that Russia attacked and that Trump and his crew aided and abetted the attack by denying it was happening, and that indeed there was a degree of collusion between, you know, Paul Manafort meeting with a guy who the reports describe as a Russian intelligence officer who might have been involved in the actual Russian operation against this. I mean, people who get on, you know, the case about no collusion and it's a hoax and all this refuse to address those facts or the fact that there was attempted collusion when Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner were told a Russian emissary is coming here with dirt on Hillary, and she's part of a secret Kremlin plan to help us in the election. And they said, great, let's meet with her and see what she has to do. This is, you know, Donald Trump Jr., famous email.
If it's what you say, I love it.
So there was an attempt at collusion, which indicated to the Russians, yeah, go ahead, do this. We don't mind. We support you doing this. So, you know, Trump and his zombies have been able to try to, you know, cast, you know, the Russia scandal as something that was made up, a hoax, a witch hunt, and all that. And, you know, unlike McCarthyism, when he said he had a list of 205 commies in the State Department, that was completely made up. He didn't have that list. Mm-hmm. On Russia, we have the receipts.
Okay. The speaking of Trump, Mickey Kouse has entered the green room. And so I won't, I just thought I should bring up that that point. Who knows whether it will resurface in Mickey's presence. But we will now, this is a moment everyone's been waiting for, I think.
Do we have a drum roll here?
Why don't you do the drum roll?
Well, that was the thing with Blogging Heads. We never had sound effects. I think it would have been a much bigger smash.
We did have, actually, this we can talk about in Mickey's presence, because we did have something better than sound effects. We had, and Mickey will recognize this phrase once he enters the conversation. Hi, Mickey. This is Mickey. I love this part. Usually people can't see this part. This is the way Mickey enters any recording, is like, he puts his face very close to the screen to try to figure out, okay, Mickey, you with us?
Is that because he's too vain to wear glasses?
Maybe.
I can only see close out of one eye, and I haven't gotten the glasses yet that would apply to both eyes.
And David's theory is that you're too vain, but we don't need to go there.
I have to press a little button, and I once punched the wrong button and it killed the podcast, so I got to make sure I press the right one.
That would have been a huge loss in this case.
It's like having your finger on the nuclear button.
Exactly.
You don't want to hit the wrong one.
Those are the stakes we're talking about, because I would hate to deprive America and the world of this. So anyway, Mickey, you're no stranger to David Corn. In fact, you introduced me to him. I don't know if you remember, but there was some brunch in D.C. you got me over to, and that's where I first met David in like the late 90s or something.
That used to be my role in D.C. I was Mr.
You were the straw that stirred the drink, Mickey.
Mr. Introduction, Mr. Fixer. I was like Bob Strauss.
Yeah.
I remember your role as being one of, how to put this nicely.
Don't make too much effort.
You were a high-end escort service for some of the most interesting people in town.
Whoa. I think we need a little elaboration. I don't think this should remain an abstraction, David.
I don't know what you mean by
Mickey
that.
Mickey was always, you know, they used to call it squiring, right? Squiring around interesting people in Washington, often women, but not always women. But you were very good at bringing people to parties.
There must be somebody in particular you're thinking of, but this reminds me of the profile in the New York Times that said I was famous for knocking boots with everybody in town, and the writer didn't know what knocking boots actually meant.
What does it mean?
It means having sex.
Oh well, and, you are famous for that. So and they just
that's not what she meant.
The truth.
That's not
knocking
what she meant.
Boots.
Was there a profile of you in the New York Times, Mickey?
When I ran for Senate, there was an unfortunate profile.
Oh, yeah. How'd that go?
It went great, Bob.
Are you now in the Senate? Are you in the U.S. Senate?
They're still counting, Bob. You know, in California, it takes a long time.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court will settle this, I'm sure, in the end.
Yeah, I'm sure you can find those illegal voters and dead voters who, you know, kept you out of the Senate.
Yeah. It wasn't close, unfortunately. But I'm heartened by the fact that none of the other quixotic candidates have come close either, except for bizarrely Ron Unz, who did very well. So what have you guys been talking about?
Kind of reflecting on changes in media since 2005, 2006, and taking a longer term view of kind of polarization, tribalism, partisan bitterness, and so on. David has actually just finished a book that's going to be out in September called American Psychosis that I gathered. So that is going to go back as far as McCarthy. Is that right? Joseph McCarthy?
Well,
Mickey is a defender of McCarthy's, by the way, but go ahead, David.
No, I'm not.
Quasi.
I mean, but it kind of goes back in some ways to the Salem witch trials, but mainly to McCarthyism.
Mickey also defends those.
Because I was thinking of just that topic, and it seems to me there are three obvious explanations. One is it's a natural sorting enabled by the web. People find the people they agree with and they like to listen to them. The second thing is it's Trump. If Hillary had been elected, would the media be this bad? I'm not so sure. And the third thing is it's those damn woke millennials and Gen Zers who are raised in a different culture, especially in colleges, and according to Ryan Grimm, are causing meltdowns in left-wing organizations across Washington. I'm sure David has better ideas.
Can adjudicate among those theories or suggest a fourth?
Yes.
Well, I think it depends what you're, you know, what you're diagnosing to begin with. I mean, there isn't one, if you want to call it a problem, there isn't one problem here. I think there are overlapping trends that, you know, that interweave with each other and that are driving us all a bit crazy. And I think they come, you know, for different reasons. I mean, I think if you just, you know, Mickey, before you got on, we were talking about just sort of political tribalism. And we were talking about, you know, how Newt Gingrich was a pioneer in a certain type of, you know, conservative demagoguery that I was arguing did not really have a parallel on the other side of the aisle, in that there's no Democrat, you know, no prominent Democrat who put out a list of words to, you know, attach to your opponents to delegitimize them as human beings. I think what he was doing was an extension of what the new right did in the 70s, and is an extension of going back, you know, to some degree to McCarthyism and Bircherism in the 50s and 60s. So I think, you know, in general, on the right, I'm talking about the GOP intersection with the right, there's been more of a drive towards a tribalism that involves the Republican Party than there has been on the left Democratic side. You know, often the left and the Democrats fight more amongst themselves than with the other side. The you know, figuring out what's happened with the media is really tough too, because, you know, how do you talk about the media? I think the natural sorting out, which also people talk about happening geographically, right?
Right.
Over the past 10, 20, 30 years, people tend to live in places now with people who share their ideas. And to me, one thing that's interesting about that is, as you know, it seems that the ideas are more divided and polarized, you know, in a way now than they were maybe in the 80s or 90s. I'm not quite positive how you would measure that. So if you're sorting out in that way now, it's the divide is bigger, I guess is what I'm saying. Like the political divide is bigger. So if you start looking for people, now does that cause you to look for people on your side that you feel comfortable with? Or does it, or by doing that, do we make the divide itself bigger? I don't know.
Probably both, but one way to look at it is I was thinking, I was reading Christopher Caldwell's book, The Age of Entitlement, and it's a pretty good book. It's chock full of, like, you know, each paragraph has a different little aperçu. And one of his arguments is that Roe versus Wade helped divide the country, that before Roe versus Wade, we were inching toward a general consensus that abortion should be legal. They were fighting it out in state legislatures. The pro-choice people were winning. And I was thinking, well, maybe if they reverse Roe, which they may be about to do, maybe that'll help bring the country together again, because we'll have to have these legislative battles. And in my experience, legislative battles actually produce a result that people are happier with, because at least they fought and won something. But then I thought, no, that's crazy. Some Republican in Alabama is going to introduce a bill. I think it's already been introduced. Anybody who thinks of having an abortion should be committed to a mental institution. And they get, people are going to get publicity for doing the craziest thing possible. And it's just going to spiral into the same sort of, crazy warfare that we've seen.
That, I think, is just truer now than it used to be, that being outrageous is rewarded. There have always been people who harnessed outrageousness. But I think something about social media and the algorithms, at least as they currently are, and maybe just the fact that people have not yet adjusted to social media and corrected accordingly in terms of how they process things. But I do think that increasingly some of the highest profile people are the people who are just most indifferent to being widely hated, right? They're just willing to be super outrageous and have a lot of people who totally hate them, but, you know, it's working for them. And I just think that's truer now than it used to be.
I think it's true because we go back to what we talked about before Mickey graced us with his presence. That's the absence of you can call them gatekeepers, but I often like to refer to them as referees. You know, if no one's calling fouls on the court, then the guy who throws elbows and steps on people's toes and has no shame about that is going to have an advantage, right? Because, you know, no one can kick him out of the game. No one can make him sit on the bench. And no one says what you said there is factually incorrect or just tremendously so outrageous that we're going to drum you out of polite society. So you're right in that there is an incentive, Bob. You get the attention, you get the clicks, and sometimes that also turns into money, not in terms of blogging heads, but for other people, if they get a lot of clicks, they can generate some money out of it. There's a financial incentive. But at the same time, there's no one to say you're wrong, no one who blows the whistle. So those are both powerful forces, and bad information is cheaper to produce. Some the lie goes around the world often faster than the truth. So bad faith actors have a tremendous advantage as of now in the world of social media and the world of online media. Go ahead.
It is true that when I'm thinking of who has been so extreme that they have been demoted in the public discourse, the way the gatekeepers or referees used to say, okay, you know, this person is crazy, we're going to ignore him or her. And it's true that the only people who have been removed are the people who Twitter has banned. I mean,
well, what about Milo? What about Milo when Breitbart abandoned him? That kind of, even Breitbart wanted to marginalize him. If you've gone that far, right?
Is he back?
Where is he?
He's working for Marjorie Taylor Greene.
An unpaid intern, but he was basically removed from the discourse when Twitter banned him, and he made the statement that everybody makes is, I'm going to be bigger than ever. I don't need Twitter. No, you need Twitter. Without Twitter, you're nothing. The same thing happened to Charles Johnson, the right-wing Charles Johnson, who's very influential and he's everywhere. He crops up in the oddest places, but he doesn't have the presence in the national discourse he used to have.
Well, you mean the guy who has, you know, arguably talked down the Holocaust?
Yes, that guy.
Okay, well,
there are two Charles Johnsons, a left-wing Charles Johnson and a right-wing Charles Johnson.
What I'm pointing out, you know, it wasn't as if he's been demoted Same with Milo for no reason. I mean, it used to be that, you know, if you said something either really wrong and got your facts wrong, or you know, that there were certain boundaries to conversation. And the social media and the internet has, you know, made it much harder for anyone to enforce those boundaries, which is one reason we have Donald Trump.
What?
Who you voted for, Mickey?
One way to get demoted is to lose an election badly. Look, there was a woman.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Donald Trump lost an election. He may not badly. But I mean, he has. And this is actually a very interesting case, because in years past, when you lose an election, and your party that you lead loses control of Congress, the party then usually kind of like sees you as being a stinker, and they don't stand by you. That no one stood by Richard Nixon in 1960. He clawed his way back after losing the governor's race in your great state of California. No one stood by Jimmy Carter afterwards and said, you know, we want you to come back, Jimmy. No one stood by George H.W. Bush. And it was all like, okay, you were demoted. We understand this. You were demoted.
But Stevenson, David. Stevenson. They loved him.
He got his job. And indeed, Dewey got nominated more than once, a few times. But I'm talking about people, particularly presidents. All these cases I think I've mentioned, well, Nixon was vice president, have been presidents who have lost. And the party has almost always said, nice to, you know, we had a good time. Nice to know you. We'll call you for the next convention. You can come in and wave.
Well, the thing about Trump is his emergence itself in 2016 reflected the fact that the party had lost the kind of power the parties used to have. They didn't want him to be the nominee.
No, they didn't. But even now, when he loses and loses Congress for them, and it wasn't just the party, I think the base kind of went along. The Goldwater base in 64 didn't want him to come back in 68. I mean, maybe some did, but there wasn't that wasn't a big push for that. And he didn't even give it a shot. So, but here you have, obviously, the base of the Republican Party is still enthralled with Trump, and to such a degree, not just to a little degree, but to such a degree that even this, what would be a normal conversation, it's time to find our next thing, cannot happen.
It's happening. It's just happening under the hovering presence of this giant who's probably going to win anyway, but it's definitely happening.
What do you mean? Under the president,
Republicans are looking for alternatives to Trump.
But you're saying Trump is going to prevail and get the nomination.
He'll probably prevail.
David's point.
Right, but no, I thought he was saying it wouldn't even happen. Well, the conversation wouldn't happen.
It's happening sub rosa among some Republicans who've always talked about how to get rid of Trump, but the party's not even able to have this conversation out in the open.
Wait till after the midterms and see. That's their chance to come out and have the conversation. But go ahead.
I keep waiting for the party to, you know, act responsibly, going back to not just, you know, you can start with Access Hollywood, but you can go back before that as well. And, you know, they just don't.
I guess so. Just a quick aside, what I was talking about was something else. It was not losing a presidential election by 9 points or whatever Trump did. It was being Orly Tate. Remember her? She was like a dentist in California. And I think she was a Tea Partier, or there was something crazy about her. Okay.
She was a birther. She was one of the lead birthers.
Oh, okay. She got a lot of press until she ran for election and got like 6% of the vote. Then she's through. Okay. So that's another way. Twitter can ban you, or you can run for election and get a minuscule portion of the vote. I think of ways you could be removed from the public discourse.
Okay,
She did better than I did, which is something that Dave Weigel kept pointing out in his blog, which drove me fucking crazy.
But yet you have not been removed from the political discourse as much as we may even want to see that happen.
I'm the Adlai Stevenson of
blogging
cranks,
heads TV.
Of cranks.
Yeah. So here's a question. So we were talking about the demise of gatekeepers. And first of all, I'm sure we'd all say, David, you'd say, as we said earlier, in fact, there are downsides. You know, there was a to an era of tight gatekeeping, right? There are views that are not getting out that should. It takes longer maybe to understand that Vietnam is a disaster, for example, and so on. There's all kinds of problems. But are we saying that Trump, the Trump presidency is a manifestation of the demise of gatekeepers? And if so, would Mickey say that's an example of how, well, I
would say that. It's the product of the elites suppressing arguments about immigration and trade and the destruction to the heartland. That were real arguments, and then they were suppressed, and then they exploded, as suppressed things tend to do.
Well, and I would say that with Trump, there's always been a lot of lying and spinning in politics, forever, but there always seemed to be like, okay, instead of getting 5 fouls in a basketball game, in politics, you would get the equivalent of 50 fouls. But, at some point, someone would come in and say, this guy is just a lying sack of a politician. And that would mean something and have an impact. Trump totally blew through that. And he made disinformation propaganda, a core part of his appeal, his campaign, his presidency. I mean, even today, I was covering the January 6th hearings, and Trump, before they begin, as he does, said, I was talking to Brad Raffensperger in November, and he told me the election was rigged and I had won in Georgia, the Secretary of State. So they get Brad Raffensperger up there, and he goes, the former president just tweeted this, or not tweeted, because he's not on Twitter. He just, whatever his social media operation that is falling apart, he did it on that. And then he had to actually send it out through an email to get it to people in the media. Anyway, he said this. And Brad says, that's wrong. That's a lie. He's making up a conversation here. Now, in years past, it would have mattered if somebody, particularly another Republican of high reputation, called out a president, politician, for lying so directly about this. But with Trump, this is now, what are we? We're in June, so he averages close to 8,000 lies a year. So this is only lie 4,000 of 2022, and so in this instance, There are no gatekeepers. I go back to my metaphor. There are no referees. And I think it's kind of sad. And Mickey, you voted for the guy. I think it's sad that Americans out there we've always accepted a certain level of dishonesty in our politicians, because otherwise we'd have no one to vote for. But to accept this titanic, Olympian level of lies from this guy, and dangerous lies all the time, to me, is something that's different.
I agree he's taken that to a new level. But I remember after Watergate, I thought, okay, you can't lie to the American people. Nixon got into trouble when his lie about, whatever the smoking gun tape showed was unveiled that he'd been lying. And then I remember George H.W. Bush, the older Bush, got in front of the cameras and said, I never said voodoo economics. And everybody knew he'd said voodoo economics. And of course, they had it on tape, him saying voodoo economics. Yeah. He knew he'd said voodoo economics. And immediately they produced a tape and showed him up as a liar. And nobody busted him for it. He wasn't damaged. They all said, ha, ha, ha. You tried to put one over on us, old George, didn't you? Okay. Like, that was the start. And I said, wait, he's the president. You get impeached if you lie to the American people. He just lied to the American people. What's happening? And so I claim that the standards were eroding before Trump. I agree that Trump is sui generis, bad.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, I think they've been eroding. You skipped the Reagan years, of course. There, I mean, I don't think George H.W. Bush was the first guy who did this. I mean, Reagan, remember his great line. I was just reading about this yesterday. And for the youngsters out there, he had this great line, there you go again, when he debated Jimmy Carter, like, you're trying to get me, there you go again. For some reason, I never understood why, people thought that was a tremendously witty effective put down. And what he was responding to was that Jimmy Carter was saying, you once called for, making Social Security voluntary or ending Medicare, one of the two things. And he had kept saying through the campaign of 1980 that he hadn't, but he had. So, Carter was trying to call him out on this particular relevant fact. And he just, there you go again, not true. Your belief, young Mickey Kouse, young idealistic Mickey Kouse, in the aftermath of Nixon's fall, believing that politicians could not lie again, it didn't take too long for the scale.
Well, that was the whole Jimmy Carter thing, of course, was I will never lie to you.
But I do think, that while there's always been an what we consider, I don't know how you measure it, an acceptable level of deception, Trump has brought it to a level that is particularly dangerous, because if we can't, agree on reality, and it's all about alternative facts, there were a million people there when there weren't, then you can't have the policy debates that you, Mickey, want to have about things. How can you have a debate with Trump or a discourse with Trump about immigration or trade or anything when he's out there, and you may like his positions, but he's still saying shit that's not true about all this stuff. I did this with the Chinese. I did this with, North Korea. There are terrorists. There are hundreds of terrorists coming in. Do you have proof of this with the illegal immigrants? No, but it could be happening. So you can't even have the honest debates that Mickey Kouse, policy meister, wants to have.
There's now some evidence for that, but the latter point. But I think there's a movement among Republicans, and we'll see after the election. There certainly the elite don't fall for his BS, and we'll see if the hardcore Trumpers are so loyal that they will keep falling for it. My friend John Ellis thinks yes, they will. I tend to think it's a close question. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, that's why that's why people are desperate to find a solution to the Trump problem. And I actually, I thought I'd come up with one.
You're going to run
yesterday. No, get Ron DeSantis to appoint Ivanka senator as part of a deal where Trump doesn't run. It requires getting either Marco Rubio or Rick Scott to stop being senator.
That's a high price to pay, but maybe not too high in this case.
That's definitely not too high.
Just one quick thing, in terms of the kind of tolerance for untruth, I don't think that's exactly what it is. I mean, I think the problem is that all the people in Trump's tribe do not trust those of us who say he's lying enough to believe us. Exaggerations they think are exaggerations, but fundamentally there's just deep distrust of mainstream media. And I don't think mainstream media is totally innocent here. I think one thing that happened with Trump is that he freaked so many people out, including me, but that the reaction in the media became so kind of inflamed that deepened the distrust of Trump supporters of the media.
But wait a second here. I'm for doing all the fucking New York Times stories about the guys in the diners too. Okay, I don't mind those stories. But the thing is, okay, who's responsible for what here? Donald Trump goes on Alex Jones's radio show, calls him a great fucking American. This is a guy who's putting forward, pollution, in terms of propaganda, disinformation. And at the time, actually, I was one of the few people who wrote about it. The media didn't go crazy about it. The media gave him fucking 3 hours of coverage every time he held a rally and just let him say whatever he said.
Sure.
My dog's getting excited. And they didn't fact check him or say, no, we're not going to show him because,
Well, Trump, that was back when they thought he wouldn't win and milking him for ratings.
Yeah, but Trump, Trump supporters, maybe they're all just damn snowflakes. I mean, no candidate ever had it so good. Okay, you know, he was treated as, you know, as a joke is a bit, but as a celebrity. And you know, there were very few stories that, I mean, I was there. There were no stories in the mainstream media about his mob ties. You know, some stories about him not paying folks who he owed money to, but not many. No real good deep dives into his conflicts of interest internationally and domestically. Nothing about
I remember reading a best-selling book about his connections to Russia.
Yeah, that was in 2018. I'm talking about up until, you know, through the election.
Go ahead and plug the book, David.
I didn't realize it was that late.
Russian Roulette by David Korn and Michael Isikoff. Hachette 12 imprint came out in 2018, number one New York Times bestseller. But I'm just saying he had such an easy ride. And so for people to say, oh, I don't trust the media because of the way they handled Donald Trump. Well, you show me one candidate who's ever run for president, or you, Mickey, who ran for Senate, who wouldn't want the deal that he got in 2015 and 2016.
I agree, that's not the part I'm talking about, Dave. I agree that, I mean, I think the media was actually pretty hard on Hillary. Again, partly because they thought she would win regardless, maybe, and partly because there was real news. Well, there was good clickbait in some of the hacked emails, you know, and so on. So they were kind of hard on Hillary during the campaign. I'm just saying that once Trump became president, I think the media reacted in a way that reinforced their in the eyes of Trump supporters.
But again, it reinforced what? I mean, what did the media cover that was untrue? This was a guy who, through 2016, was trying to score hundreds of millions of dollars in a deal with Moscow.
I'm not saying they said things that were untrue. It was so obvious that they were working to highlight whatever they could that was bad about him. I mean, I just think in that sense.
You say the same thing about Bill Clinton, you know, supporters in the 90s, or, you know, or Barack Obama. No one talks about, you know, Barack Obama took a bunch of hits after, you know, when he, you know, I say after 2010. And now we're going to bend over backwards to understand why Barack Obama supporters and pissed off at the media.
Here's a good example. There were these Border Patrol agents on horseback that Biden, echoing a lot on the left, said had whipped Haitian migrants. There's no evidence they whipped Haitian migrants. The photographer who took the picture said they didn't whip Haitian migrants. And this is just bullshit. And the president of the United States spouted it, and everybody on the left believes it. And they're about to discipline these poor suckers for something they didn't do. So that would be one good example of just going too far. Everything, there's a partisan fact generating machine on both sides is out of control.
But this happens all the time. In the 1980s, Reagan said, we're not supporting people committing massacres in El Salvador. And A.M. Rosenthal, the New York Times, killed Ray Bonner's great work on all this. You know, they at El Mazote and other places, they were killing hundreds of people. Okay. And so people were right to be suspicious of Reagan and were right to be suspicious of the New York Times. This shit happens all the time. I mean, there's something, but then that doesn't mean that I go running around and looking at, I don't know, Mondale or Dukakis and believe any shit they say, because I'm pissed off by how the media is covering the issue.
You can't read today's New York Times and not think, A, it is changed from A.M. Rosenthal's New York Times. It's way to the left, much more partisan. And B, if you're on the right, you're not going to believe the New York Times the way you used to under A.M. Rosenthal, because it's way more biased to the left.
I don't think it's just right left. There's something in the tone of coverage. There's more explicit editorializing in purportedly straight news coverage and in headlines. I mean, David, I'll give you an example. It used to be the norm, I think, in straight up reportorial journalism, that it wasn't your job to call something a lie. You would say he said this. And then if there was clear contrary evidence, you'd cite the evidence. If somebody on the other side said, what he said isn't true. You'd quote them, but it wasn't the journalist's job to use the word lie. That changed after Trump, and the New York Times started putting lie in the headline, and they still do. And that's what I mean is, like, Trump supporters are not imagining that they changed the rules for Trump. Now, you and I might say he lied more than any president ever, which I believe is the case.
Right.
I'm just telling you what it looks like to people who are Trump supporters. That changes the rules in their imagination.
But you know what? Complaining about media coverage to justify your support of a liar is bogus. It's bullshit. If you care.
I'm not doing that because I don't support him.
Okay, but to justify, to say, oh, these people are accepting Trump because they don't like the way the media is covering him and it's unfair the way they cover him.
Mickey's got a bigger media hit even than us, I think. I'm serious.
He's getting called to do a Facebook chat. Oh, 30 seconds.
Okay. I have a pre-existing radio commitment. The point is, we're just trying to explain why people on the right can't be talked to by the media anymore, not whether they're justified or not supporting.
I'm not trying to justify Trump or them.
We're explaining why the media can't be gatekeepers. That's all. I got to go.
I agree with that, but at the same point, I think it lets off people easy, in terms of, they're still out there. Whatever their attitude is towards the media, they're still supporting a tremendous liar who lies literally about everything Mickey has to go. So
I think you timed this well, David. He has to leave without replying.
Okay. Bye, Mickey. Okay. See you. See you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what Mickey would have said, which is like actually a hobby horse of mine, is that you should be able to explain why bad people are doing things or people who are considered bad are doing things without being accused of justifying the behavior. I see this all the time. You know, I personally think, I don't want to get into a big Ukraine war argument, but I personally think the U.S. has mismanaged its relationship with Russia. I like to point that out. I think NATO expansion was stupid. And when people say, oh, those are Putin talking points, you're a Putin apologist, it's just bullshit. I'm just trying to explain to you that I think we made a foreign policy mistake of a kind we shouldn't repeat. So I get kind of sensitive about this conflation between explaining and excusing. Sorry, I'll calm down.
I understand that. And I was one of the why are we expanding NATO lefties in the 90s and aughts as well. And it's a really interesting conversation to have. And particularly when it becomes the way it's become so circular in that, I'm not justifying what Putin did, but, and I'm not saying if we had not expanded NATO, that this would not have happened, but certainly it created this dance now where NATO seems relevant when 20 years ago, it might not have been relevant. But nevertheless, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole with you. I mean, to me, the problem is not Trump. Let me just bring it back. The problem is not the media. The problem is that tens of millions of Americans look at Trump and either believe or accept his lies, as well as his bigotry, his hatred, his pettiness, his narcissism, and say, yeah, that's what we want more of. I mean, if it wasn't for that, Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy could have bounced him, and if it wasn't for that, he obviously wouldn't have been elected. And the problem here is that there's this degree of, whether you want to call it grievance, resentment, whether a lot of it is fueled by racism or on the ease over changing demographics, wherever you want to put it, that we have a society that has, been infected or influenced, whether you want to be pejorative enough, by all these trends. So enough Americans are willing to put aside the values and standards that we used to at least, pretend to have.
Yeah, look, I'm as alarmed as anybody else. I mean, it's funny, this will not air for, a week or two. So anything we say about the January 6th hearings are not, hot off the presses. But I just tuned in every once in a while to these. And but every time I do, it's like usually it's something I already knew. And yet I'm still blown away. It's like to be reminded, like, of that phone call with Raffensperger. You know, that was like today, and I had heard the phone call, and I'm just going. And then the new stuff I hear, like the discussions, you know, over this whole Eastman scheme within the White House, you know, and the thing that Pence's lawyer was the count, you know, Pence's lawyer arguing with him and so on. The new stuff I hear blows me away. The stuff I already knew blows me away. Look, I do work hard to step back and understand what drives Trumpism. David, I don't know if you know, but I'm among the Americans who can say, probably not many of your friends can say this, but three of my four siblings voted for Trump. So I'm, you know, I'm kind of in touch with this. And, you know,
well, I think politically we need to understand why people vote the way they vote. That's what politics is all about. And that's, whoops, let me let the dog out so she can go.
Definitely. Let me see if I can see the dog. Damn it.
That's what politics, organizing is reaching people where they are, not where you want them to be, blah, 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 blah. So I think it is important to understand. But I also don't want to get into the position of excusing Americans who support someone who incites insurrectionist violence.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, we have to understand why they feel this way. Well, yes and no. And, I was at I didn't go to the hearing, the one that's happening today when we're recording, but I went to the first two and I was in the room. And I watched, you know, the videos that they show again, and I've watched all the videos. I've watched all the videos produced by the New York Times and everybody else, so, you know, documentaries that have come out and so on. CNN, I think, did a good one, too. And every time I watch it, I am just irate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just irate because I feel like, you know, one of the few things that we...
Your dog really is like mine.
Yeah. Come on.
Chronic malcontent. Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
And I'm all right because America is a big country. We have a lot of differences here, a lot of different people, different stories, different backgrounds, different locations. But there's, you know, but we all have, a shared interest. We all own stock in our government for good or bad. And for what, you know, and hopefully in the ideals that we, you know, that we hope it can, you know, someday attain, at least strive towards. And so when I see people, attacking the Capitol that way, I really feel like, you know, I own a little piece of that. I pay taxes. Yeah. You know, I live in the D.C. area. I own a little piece of that. And it makes me really pissed off. And the fact that, you know, a lot of Americans are just, you know, dismissing it, don't care. And a lot of the leading Republicans. It's like, what does it take? What, you know, what justifies, you know, Kevin McCarthy, Mitch McConnell, every other Republican out there to just downplay, dismiss this, ignore this, say it doesn't matter. And, you know, while they're also out there passing laws at the state level, try to gain more control of the counting process for votes, for elections. It's not whether they're doing this because they don't like cultural change, or they never had the debate over trade and immigration policy that Mickey was talking about that they want. To a certain degree, well, it doesn't matter if that leads them to this point. Become threats to
the American system. Yeah, but don't system. You, I mean, I think I'm as alarmed as you are about, in part because I worry that this is actually part of larger structural things, which is going to make it even harder to attack. But don't you agree that if you analyze what motivates them, and that leads you to conclude that, hey, you know, there's some policies Democrats could float that would actually be quite consistent with Democratic values, like do more things for working people or unemployed people or whatever. I mean, that analysis is worthwhile at a minimum, right?
Yeah. You know where I come from. That's the type of Democratic policy I want. But you also know that, you know, there was a great book that came out about Trump voters called Identity Crisis. Forgive me for not remembering the names of the three academics who co-wrote it. But, you know, not surprisingly, you know, their conclusion was that it was mainly about race and identity.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you remember Heather McGee's book that came out a couple of years ago, in which she, you know, used as a metaphor the story of the swimming pools that, you know, that when it was time, when they were ordered to be integrated,
mm-hmm.
this is a southern town, the white people decided they'd rather not have swimming pools than have integrated swimming pools. So they would take away something that they themselves enjoyed. You know, yeah. So coming in and saying, as a Democrat, say in this instance, we can give you better swimming pools. But, you know, they wouldn't want that because to them, the race factor was more. So yes, I do believe that Democrats, like Sherrod Brown in Ohio and others, should be fighting for progressive populist policy issues. I mean, to me, it's pretty obvious. If you look at, you know, the whole fight over Build Back Better, that the Democrats are saying, do you want your teeth after you're 65 years of age? You're going to have dental mm-hmm. and your Medicare coverage. 25% of West Virginians over the age of 65 have no teeth. So why the fuck is Manchin not doing everything he can to try to give these people teeth? Why is that not good politics and good policy? You know, people say they want, you know, paid leave for you know, parental leave and for illnesses and for taking care of kids or your elders. People want universal pre-K. I mean, there are all these things out there that clearly one side wants to deliver, and one side says no, too much money, you know, deficits, which they didn't care about before, and it seems kind of obvious to me. I'd like the Democrats to make it more obvious, the way Truman ran in, in 48 against the Do Nothing Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, my fear, having looked at what's happened with Trumpism, Bob, is that that's still not enough.
Let me ask you this.
And then we should close. Because
this is a good wrap up question. Maybe it's actually not that great. It's a good something. But let's assume that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are not the candidate. I realize one of them probably will be, much to my dismay personally. But if they weren't, who would your choice be for somebody who can win a general election? Which Democrat?
I'm flummoxed. Oh. I don't. The answer is.
Well, right, you now, mentioned Sherrod Brown. Now, there are rumors that he has a skeleton in his closet or something. But doesn't he fit the profile?
He fits, you know, if you want sort of a feisty roll up your sleeves, you know, union guy. Yeah, he does. I mean, I don't know if there's any credence to any of those rumors about him. And after Trump, why should we care? I know his wife, Connie, she's great. And she, you know, they have a great, from the outside, you never can tell, but from the outside, they have a great relationship and they seem to. So if she's good by him, you know, after Trump, why should we care what any skeletons
right.
there are?
Right.
You know, and I've always liked him. I'd be interesting to see, you know, but he's kind of that scruffy guy. And, you know, is that, can that work in national? I mean, given the threat that I think we face from Trumpism, with or without Trump, I'm all for, you know, winning. I mean, I think it's just totally. I think it's too perilous to give Trump or a Trumpist, you know, that power again, and to have them learn from all the missed opportunities last time. So I don't think right now the Democratic bench looks that strong. I've always liked Murphy,
Chris Murphy
in Connecticut. Although he hasn't, you know, he's not shown an interest in running nationally, you know, last cycle or two, so maybe he doesn't want to. Not everybody wants to do this. I understand that. That probably just means they're saner than most politicians. So I don't know. I really, you know, I think it's tough. And then, you know, you look at, we had this question with Barack Obama, but, you know, whether a Black American can become president. I was always very doubtful, and I, until the very end, I was doubtful that, that he could win just because of racism. But could a woman win, particularly a Democratic woman who's not, you know, like the Iron Lady, like Thatcher in England? Could a gay American win? Could Pete Buttigieg?
I worry.
I still think those are difficult questions to contend with. I would not say that people shouldn't run or vote for that, but I think those are still real questions.
Chris Murphy's a good example, and I'll let you go after this, but of what I think is the case, which is that you don't have to have some highly charismatic. Chris Murphy's not very charismatic, but he's a smart guy who, if you put him next to Trump on a debate stage, will just seem like the reasonable adult in the room. And he's, whereas with Joe Biden, you know, there are days when you have doubts about whether he's still, still got it all together. And Kamala Harris pushes various people's buttons in ways that would not be entirely fortunate. I just think you have to put somebody next to Trump who seems like, yeah, I could see that person in the White House, and they don't drive me crazy. Because I think Trump, he's even older. He's, you know, a lot of people would love to vote for somebody other than Trump. Just give them somebody they don't dislike. That's my theory of the case. But
I thought, you know, any generic Democrat people didn't know would have beaten Trump. You know, people didn't, you know.
Instead of Hillary.
Yeah. You know, it's, you know, again, you know, hate, unfortunately, is a pretty powerful motivator.
Yeah.
So if people don't like a candidate, it's hard for people to get over that. I think, you know, a middle of the road, milquetoast, non-exciting Democrat who doesn't cause concern is not a bad way to go if Trump's going to be the nominee. If it's going to be Ron DeSantis, then you got a different thing going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Right. Then you need something that's more positive and proactive, not just someone who's not just a non-Trump. So, check back in a year and we'll see if anybody has emerged.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, David. And thank you for being in on this from the beginning. And
I'll tell you, I mean, I always really relished doing Blogging Heads. I thought it was a great thing you put on. I liked watching it. I liked doing it sometimes. It was sometimes multi-generational with younger journalists. And the debates and discussions that I always had were always civil. You know, sometimes they weren't amusing. And even when they weren't amusing, they still were civil.
Yeah.
And I do miss that. But I thank you for providing that platform, and, you know, perhaps as a goal, something to strive for, we can aim for the, you know, instead of classic rock, classic Blogging Heads. That could be our lodestar.
That is America's lodestar. I think you put it better than I possibly could have. And I'll try to turn that into some kind of ad that we run in the Super Bowl or something. Well, thank you so much. Everybody should buy American Psychosis, and they should subscribe in September, I mean, your book, and subscribe to Our Land, your newsletter. And my newsletter is called Non-Zero, as is now what used to be called Blogging Heads, which means this podcast, this YouTube channel, and so on. So I'll let you get back to finishing the book we're all going to read, David. And then when you're all done and rested up, you can come back and talk to us some more.
Yeah, let's do it when the book's out. But thanks.
All right. Okay.
See you soon.
All right. See ya.